Right.
Thank you again.
Well, there may be some of you who have been waiting here since before 5 o'clock and expecting to see Mike Pommery take the chair and are now beginning to wonder whether you are in the right place. Well, I can assure you, if you've come for an ordinary general meeting of the Institute of Actuaries, that you are in the correct place, and that our president is currently in South America looking after our best interests. Tough work, but somebody's got to do it, so I'm told. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on the 24th of October have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Now, we have quite a large number of official guests tonight, and I extend a warm welcome to them. They are Robert Laslett of the Department for Work and Pensions, Dr. Stephen Satchell from Cambridge University, Professor William Peredin and Dr. Turalai Kench, both from the Tanaka Business School, Imperial College London, Professor David Webb from the London School of Economics, Ashby Monk from Oxford University, and Dr. Juan Coco from the London Business School. And I'd also like to extend a very warm greeting to personal guests of members. Now, I'm delighted to welcome Mark Humphreys to this meeting. Mark is the winner of the McKinsey Prize for Communication, awarded to the best performing student in the communications paper in the April 2005 examination diet. The award of this prize has been made possible by McKinsey & Company offering to provide sponsorship to the profession. In addition to providing the prize, McKinsey's will also sponsor other educational work undertaken by the profession. I'd now like to ask Mark to step forward so that I may present him with his certificate and chair. Now we have another prize winner today, Leanne Pinder, who has been awarded a prize by the Worshipful Company of Actuaries for her performance in the subject Pensions and Employee Benefits, also in the April 2005 diet. And I'd like to invite the Master of the Worshipful Company, Jeremy Goford, to present the prize to Leanne. Okay.
To make a little advertisement for the Worshipful Company, so that those of you who are interested may consider joining. It's a modern company. It was founded in 1979. It's a livery company of the city. Liverymen elect the Lord Mayor and the Sheriffs of the city. And a very important part of our work is you pay charitable contributions to the fund, and we disperse that throughout the city and also in the boroughs around the city for deserving charities where we can make a difference. So you will be interested in joining the Worshipful Company if, say, you are 10 years qualified or more, you earn enough to be able to contribute something to our charitable trust, so that's all of you, and are city interested in city governance, or even if you're interested in becoming Lord Mayor. We've had a sheriff, but we would like to have someone join the livery company and become Lord Mayor. So there are lots of opportunity. And by the way, we dine in nice halls as well. But now I'd like to present Leanne with her prize, very well deserved, for coming top in the view of the examiners in the pensions and employee benefits examinations. Leanne.
To our two prize winners, we now come to tonight's main event. A paper by Mirko Cardinali, Gabriel Katz, Jayesh Kumar and Michael Ortzag on the subject of background risk and pensions. I'm not quite sure how background some of the risks referred to in the paper really are, but I would like to ask Martin Wheel to open the discussion. Martin.
No? Try that. Introduce the paper.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Try again.
I'll try again. All right.
Okay, and actually, right. You'd invited me to take a little bit extra long to discuss the paper. I wasn't expecting to be...
Well, I'll invite two of the authors, okay. Mike Ortzag and Mirko Cardinali, to introduce the paper.
Okay, the paper's on background risk and pensions, and if one conclusion of the discussion is background risk is so important that we call it foreground risk, I'll be quite happy. The financial economics discussions in the actual profession have largely been in the context of the classical economic model in which markets are perfect. This model makes a number of simplifying assumptions. All contingent claims are tradable and ownership property rights are well defined. But these are assumptions, and they break down quite a bit in the long-term setting faced by insurance schemes and also by life insurance funds. Now, there are a number of ways we can consider what to do when these assumptions all contingent claims being tradable and ownership property rights being well-defined breakdown. We take the approach that is closest to the one that's been adopted in the economic literature, the mainstream economic literature, of explicitly modeling background risks in an expected utility framework. Background risks are unhedgeable risks which cannot be diversified away. They're not always financial. They include regulatory and policy risks. For instance, changes in the legal requirements on pension liabilities associated with the PPF or associated with changes in pension laws are things which can't be hedged, can't be diversified away easily, and would count as background risks, as would changes in the tax regimes. Again, not easily hedgeable by pension funds. Changes in the legal definition of liabilities also would be a background risk. There are labor market risks that are background risks, such as aggregate wage movements. Now, some people would argue part of long-term aggregate wage movements can be hedged. I know there have been debates about this. But the part that can't be hedged is a background risk. There are also other labor market risks, such as early retirement rates and changes in turnover, which cannot be hedged by individual funds and are not things that can be easily diversified away. Mortality is another risk, which is unhedgeable to a large degree and cannot be diversified away, though there are some instruments in the market that are changing this or trying to change this. And there are potentially some long-term financial markets risks, particularly outside the UK, which cannot be hedged by long-term financial instruments. So there are a wide range of background risks. They are quite important. You could argue that some of these background risks could be hedged in the future through new financial instruments, and they can, but it's costly to introduce these instruments. And there's a literature about introduction of financial instruments, it has a number of conclusions. But we start in this paper from the assumption that these markets don't exist and work through some of the conclusions, because these are risks that are endemic in pension schemes. Next slide. So the paper starts in section 2 with a review of the economic literature on background risk. This is a broad literature dating back to the 1960s. One of the papers cited in the next slide is a paper jointly authored by Joseph Stiglitz, and it was one of the papers for which he won the Nobel Prize on Economics of Uncertainty Information. There's been a considerable effort in the past 30 years, more than 30 years, of developing a literature on what happens when markets are incomplete and imperfect. And we review some of this. We take a view more from the individual's point of view than looking at background risk and how it affects firms, but there are papers in this area as well. We then proceed to review the types of background risks affecting pension schemes, the ones I mentioned on the previous slide, mortality, wage rate risks, and catalog others. I think the point here is people have focused on background risk being mortality, yet in practice there are a lot of other important background risks to take into account, including regulatory and policy risks. Then we follow up with a conceptual discussion of the applicability of the economic literature to pensions. Now, I think we have to be quite careful here, because although some of the constructs, like preferences and utility functions, are relevant in pensions, there's some subtle differences. In economics, when we talk about utility as something that depends on consumption and wealth, in pensions, we will be talking about the contributions made on funding and the overall funding position, the net asset position of the scheme. And the constraints are slightly different. Instead of it being a lifetime wealth constraint that faces an individual or resource constraint affecting a firm, it's an asset liability constraint over the long run that affects a pension scheme. But whether the decision maker is a firm, in which case we have to be careful that markets are incomplete and there are agency problems, and therefore that leads to certain decision-making frameworks that are, it's appropriate to use utility theory, or there are various adjustment costs. And it seems quite sensible that pension liabilities are so large relative to the size of some firms that cash flow considerations and other things associated with pensions are very, very important in practice. Though for very small pension schemes, we have to be careful about taking utility modeling considerations too far. But clearly, from the point of view of sponsors, utility and formal modeling of objective functions is quite important. The second point I'd like to raise, though, as well, is that the way pensions are structured is very complicated, and much more complicated than maybe the structure of a problem that faces an individual. For instance, we talk about risk aversion quite a lot in the paper, and for individuals, it's reasonable to assume that relative risk aversion, or the amount people are willing to pay for a percentage shock to their wealth, to avoid a percentage shock to their wealth, doesn't vary across their wealth levels, or absolute risk aversion, the amount they're willing to pay for an absolute gamble, declines across wealth levels in a monotonic fashion. For pension funds, it could be more complicated. If we consider a pension fund that's not well-funded at all, especially in the current environment with the PPF, the sponsor may be risk-loving. They aren't going to be in a situation where they're going to be highly risk-averse and willing to put a lot of money into bonds. And as the funding level improves, they will become more risk-averse, and then at higher funding levels, they could be less risk-averse. So the pattern's not monotone, and it could have a very complicated shape, and it could be scheme-specific. So we have to be quite careful that objective functions that come from the economic literature may not be applicable to pensions. We address three questions in the paper, and those questions are, what is background risk due to asset allocation? What is background risk due to funding decisions? And what is background risk due to fair value calculations? I think there are two dangers in the current debate about background risk and unhedgeable risk and how they affect pensions. Danger one is in a myth, is that background risk should be ignored. Just invest in bonds and everything will be okay. And this background risk is just noise on the side, and people should just invest in bonds. And I think that's one thing that we seek to address with this paper. The second myth that needs to be avoided is that background risk should lead to more equity investment, because it doesn't matter that much if you put a little bit more money in equity. And there's actually no need to put a lot more money into pension plans, because things could get better in the future. And that's also a myth, because there are a number of considerations. Background risk leads to high level of risk, which may mean that you're more conservative. On the other hand, the argument is correct that the marginal cost of investing in equity is lower. in the case where you have this background risk. And the two considerations can go in either direction. Next slide. Now, the economic literature on background risk is, as I said, extensive, and the paper goes through some of it. Mentioned some key papers in this bullet point. Savings due to background risk is called precautionary saving. In the paper, we call extra funding due to background risk precautionary funding. And this is driven by prudence. Actuaries use the word prudence, but economists use it in a different way. The way economists use it is tied to the convexity of the marginal value of consumption, at least in the individual problem it is, in the background risk variable. And there are a number of papers on this subject. This, in most economic applications, and we argue in the paper this is not necessarily always applicable in the more complicated pension applications, relates to the third derivative of the utility function, just as risk aversion is a second derivative property. Curvature of preferences is what determines asset allocation. The way the curvature changes, the way the risk aversion changes, is what determines prudence. And if there is precautionary savings, and if prudence is positive, it leads to a positive margin in pricing assets. It leads to a degree of prudence in assumptions, which is something that actuaries do intuitively, though I think this could be made a bit more formal. How about asset allocation? Is it the case that if we have background risk that we are going to put less money into equity or keep things the same? And admittedly, in some of the models that have been developed in the actuarial literature, background in the classical portfolio models, the mean variance type models in the actuarial literature, background risk doesn't matter. But if we consider this a very simple model, and this is a textbook model, and I know Martin Wheel is going to talk about it briefly as well, and I've changed this a bit. We've changed this a bit to give it more of a pension context. Replaced asset level with funding, the funding level. And it's reasonable, you'd think, to assume that at low levels of funding, the marginal value of extra funding is higher than at high levels of funding. So in this particular objective function, you get twice as much benefit from an extra unit of funding when you're underfunded than you do when you're overfunded. So again, objective function, if you're below 100% funding, you get twice as much benefit than if you're over 100% funding. Very simple objective function with a kink at 100%. Now let's start out with a model with four states of the world. And we start out at 101% funding. We're 1% over full funding. 101% funded, and we have a choice of investing in a risky asset with two very extreme returns. I could change these returns. The results won't change. I want to stick as close as possible to the we want to stick as close as possible to the textbook example here. The returns are plus 190%, minus 100%. Minus 100%, you lose all your money. 190%, you get a big return on average. Equally probable returns, 45% returns. Over the long run, it's not unreasonable to have a high rate of return and a high level of risk. In states 1 and 3, you lose all your money, all the money invested in the risky asset. So what you'll get at the end of the period, end of the period in states 1 and 3, is 101% what you originally had minus anything you invested in the risky asset. States 2 and 4, the risky asset does very well, and you get 101% plus whatever you invested times 190%. What is the investment in the risky asset? One unit of the risky asset gets purchased. This is exactly the conclusion that Zvi Bodhi and others would argue for. You invest in bonds until you're fully funded, and then above that, you put money in equity. Okay. So very simple model leads to a very simple conclusion. You put everything in bonds, and then above that, if you have a little bit of funding cushion, you invest a bit in equity. What happens when we introduce background risk? And let's introduce a very simple type of background risk, something that's additive. It raises in states 1 and 2, it raises the funding ratio to 111% in the absence of investment in risky assets. Liabilities improve due to changes in mortality, changes in labor risk, changes in policy, whatever. Things improve. In states 3 and 4, it gets worse. It goes down to 91%. These are random changes to the solvency level outside the control of the person making decisions about the scheme. And again, we have in states 1 and 3 asset markets that have returns of minus 100%. And states 2 and 4, we have positive returns. What happens? How much is invested in risky assets? 11 units get purchased. 11 units. That's more than a tenfold increase in the risk exposure when you've introduced background risk. And I can engineer higher increases in risk exposure. This doesn't always happen. In the simplified setting, where there's one source of risk, where the risk is additive, and there's only one decision variable, the actual effect of background risk depends on the convexity of risk aversion. In other words, it's just as precautionary savings is a property of the third derivative of the utility function, or the rate at which the curvature of preferences changes. The effect on asset allocation depends on the curvature of the curvature of preferences. A complicated thing, and very complicated to measure in practice. So it is a very difficult thing for us to consider. The reason it depends on convexity is if we're considering shocks that perturb a value of a background risk variable, if the risk aversion level is convex, that means on average risk aversion is going to be higher, and risk aversion when it's high means you invest less in the risky asset. Jensen's inequality has to do with convexity of risk aversion. In practice, though, things are much more complicated. As we argue in the paper, there's a mixture of multiplicative and additive risks. There are multiple sources of risks, and there are multiple decisions going on. And therefore, it's important for us to consider more complicated models. Now, next slide. Now, we took the tact in the paper of, instead of having one really complicated model with things like covenant risk explicitly in there, and having credit risk of the sponsor explicitly in there, and all sorts of complicated things, and modeling the different stakeholders in a particularly detailed way, we chose the tact of just presenting three different models. And the results of these three different models do confirm what I said earlier, that the effect of background risk on asset allocation can go either way. Surprisingly, the effect on funding can go either way in the models we consider. Yes, we could consider more complicated models, but I think it's a strength of the paper that we considered a variety of models rather than just one, and space is quite limited. Now, Mirko Cardinale is going to talk about just one or two results from one of the three models in the paper, and then talk about implications for actual practice.
Thanks, Mike. We briefly review one of the models presented in the paper. And this is, of course, we focus on three different models. This is one of them. First of all, we consider a two-period model. So there are only two periods that we are interested in. And we assume that the pension scheme chooses an equity allocation for period one and period two, and chooses also a funding level for period one. We implicitly assume that the deficit at the end of period two is covered by funding inflows at the end of the period. This scheme is 85% funded, which is broadly in line with a recent UK experience. And we consider the case of deterministic liabilities, so in other words, no background risk, and the case of stochastic or with background risk. And we assume that background risk is uncorrelated with the risky asset returns or the equity returns. This is one illustrative result. Essentially, what we are showing is the optimal equity allocation when we keep funding fixed. We also consider in the paper the case of fixed funding. We can also consider a case of fixed equity allocation and optimal funding, and we also consider the case of variable funding and asset allocation. In this particular case, what we are showing is the implied optimal equity allocation implied by our simple two-period model, and we display in this chart how the optimal equity allocation changes for different value of the what we call the period two funding aversion parameter. What this parameter says essentially is that the greater the value of the parameter, the more the fund is averse to deficit at the end of the second period, or in other words, is averse to having to put more money at the end of the second period because the two are equal, because as we said, the award ends at the end of the second period. Essentially, what we show here is, well, first of all, we will expect the shape of the relationship is increasing. Basically, the higher the value of the parameter, the more we put in equities, because we assume that the scheme is only 85% funded at the outset. But more importantly, what happens when we include background risk? Essentially, as Mike was discussing before, background risk in this particular case leads to higher equity allocation. So this is an example, even in a simplified setting, where adding unhedgeable background risk leads to higher equity exposure. Now, these are some conclusions, some implications out of this simple model. Of course, there are more models that we present in the paper, but these are the key conclusions that we can take away. Essentially, first of all, we have a conclusion for the risk budgeting process. Essentially, we show that even in our simple model, risk aversion changes with the level of funding. And the shape of this relation could well be scheme-specific, because different schemes have different preferences. So our implication here is it's not just about risk tolerance. We have to have a more complex picture of how risk tolerance changes with, for instance, the level of funding. So we would encourage perhaps actuaries should engage into broader debates about risk with the trustees, and perhaps running some revealed preference experiments. The second point is about making joint decision on funding and asset allocation. As we show in some of the results in the paper, when decisions are taken jointly, the results are different. So in other words, if we keep asset allocation fixed, we might get a result in funding. If we take the two together, we might get a different result. So it's important. Key implication, it's important to stress how asset allocation and funding should be part of the same problem. And the third point we'd like to make is that background risk, even in a simplified setting as the one we focus on, does seem to matter for both liability and funding calculations. And if that's the case, then perhaps this should be explicitly taken into account by the valuation process. And of course, that might imply that pension schemes that are more exposed to background risk might end up with higher liabilities or higher liability estimates. And there are many examples of that. For instance, an open versus a closed scheme may be one example of higher exposure to wage growth. And many more examples can be taken. But these are the main conclusions. Now, we're very happy then to hear your views and comments, and I guess we'll have some time at the end to wrap up. And, well, first of all, we have...
asking Martin to open the discussion.
Okay, well...
Okay, well, thank you very much. I would certainly like to calculate the authors on an excellent paper, which I think draws attention to what has to be a key issue for anyone involved in running or advising a pension fund. Background risk is always present. There have to be divergences between the sponsors, the trustees, and I think possibly also between the trustees in some circumstances and the beneficiaries. At the very least, I can imagine circumstances where you have different categories of beneficiaries with different interests, and the trustees have to do some sort of balancing exercise. Well, that final aspect certainly wasn't discussed here, and I did wonder slightly how it was done. But I should say, judging this paper against the sort of thing that in many spheres is popular, scenario analysis, I must say I think it's a great advance, because it's trying not only to say what might happen, but how big is the probability associated with particular things happening, and on that basis to try and advise on a response to the risk that is faced. Well, I... No, in looking at this paper, I found myself asking the question, how do the models there relate to the sorts of things that I'm familiar with as an economist? And economists, of course, have famously narrow minds. The structure that I wanted to look at was where people are worried about consumption in period one and period two. They have a safe asset with return rho. They have a risky asset with return r plus epsilon, where epsilon is a random variable. The person is concerned, or the agent is concerned about, you know, allocating their resources across two periods, but they don't know whether they're going to survive into the second period or not. Pi is the probability of survival. You have an initial wealth holding and you have to spend out of that over those two periods, and the decision that you face is how much should you spend in period, how much should you consume in period one. Jointly with that, how much should you invest in the safe asset or the risky asset, and those two together determine your expected consumption in period two. The term delta, which I haven't labelled, is a discount factor that consumption in period two is less valuable than in period one, simply because we have to wait for it. And this is saying then that welfare depends on the utility, the welfare we get from consumption in period one, and the discounted expected welfare that we get in period two. Well, so no, that's the maximisation problem. And let's now suppose that the survival probability is not correlated with the return on the risky asset. That may or may not be the case, but if it's not the case, and in the specific circumstance where it's constant, you can then take it outside the expectation sign, or you take its expectation outside the expectation sign. And no, then at least in some circumstances the model, the problem separates quite nicely. How much do I spend in period one, and how do I allocate my residual portfolio? Well, the specific circumstance in which that happens is when the utility function has that sort of structure. Now, that's a structure that is popular with economists in some sense because it has the property I describe, that the, you know, the curvature, the degree of risk aversion is, or of relative risk aversion, is the same everywhere, and that implies that the portfolio allocation is independent of the background risk, the mortality risk. That in some sense is rather appealing, because looked at on the face of things, why should a large pension fund have a different portfolio structure from a small pension fund if in other respects it's the same? I can see that if you have, you know, a small number of beneficiaries with a large pensions, well, at the very least, the structure you might want would depend on what else, you know, on their circumstances, and that might be different from one where you have a lot of beneficiaries with a small, you know, eating into a pot of the same size. But no, in more general terms, why should the portfolio structure of a pension fund be size dependent? Well, you might say that the examples that Mike gave were normally normalised so that they weren't size dependent. But in the standard, no, what I regard as the standard framework, Mike might well say that it's actually a very specific framework. But in what I regard as the standard framework, you can separate out the background risk from the investment decision. Now, are there some examples one can think of where there might plausibly not be that separability? Well, Mike described the case where the risk was additive. I must say, I think it being multiplicative, it, no, seems to me inherently more plausible, because background risk being uncertainty about your mortality rates, you might think on the face of it, is not normally additive to uncertainties about the return on equities. On the other hand, I can think of some examples where you would get an interaction. Take the Black Death. The Black Death was a shock to the mortality rate, but at the same time it had the effect that it sharply reduced the workforce. In the aftermath of the Black Death, wages went up, rental rates on land fell, and therefore presumably land prices fell. And if a sort of Black Death type background risk was something that an actuary was concerned about, then she or he would also have to take account of the interaction between the mortality risk being different from what was expected and what was going to happen to the return on assets when that sort of thing, should that eventuality materialise. In the example, the four-state example attributed to Gollier, the welfare function was kinked. Now, you might say that if the welfare function was kinked, then the utility function that's being analysed can't be that of the beneficiaries, because it's a bit difficult to imagine why beneficiaries should have a kinked welfare function. If my pension falls short by 1% of what I had expected, one might think that my reaction to that wouldn't be terribly different from what happened if it exceeded what I was expecting by 1%. And as those shortfalls or excesses shrink towards zero, you would expect, at least I would expect, the divergence between the two to go away. Whereas in the example quoted, the function was kinked and the structure of the optimum portfolio was essentially driven by the nature of the kink, and indeed without that kink, because the function was linear, you didn't have risk aversion at all. So it was something which may be a sensible approximation or a sensible teaching tool, but on its own it doesn't strike me as a terribly realistic representation of the situation that as a beneficiary, no, of the situation that I might face as a beneficiary. The sort of general thrust of the paper was, however, that the link between the background risk and portfolio risks, I think, was the norm rather than the exception. And as I say, from my point of view, that is an issue. Is the structure I've written down a useful and general one, or is it a specific case that actuaries are unlikely to find themselves facing? I would value the views of the speaker, of the speakers on that. Leaving aside the question of the Black Death, one can think of some more up-to-date reasons why the purely proportional situation that I was describing might not arise. And in some sense, this is replicating what Mike was saying. If you have a pension fund which is nearly insolvent, then the trustees might well take the view that they may as well invest the remaining assets on the 325 at Newmarket, because if that comes in, they'll have done a good job and rescued the pension fund. If it doesn't come in, well, they'll be bailed out by the new pension protection fund anyway, and that, of course, is how moral hazard can distort choices. That, I think, was the situation, though, why you might expect a non-linearity for a very poorly, why you might expect a departure from the sort of structure I defined for a very poorly funded scheme. I'm a bit less clear why you would expect it from a very well-funded scheme, why you might expect to have the kink at the point where the scheme is reported as being notionally solvent. Well, of course, the reason given is that having an unfunded scheme is an embarrassment. Having having a scheme which is not fully funded is an embarrassment. Having one which is fully funded or more than funded is not an embarrassment, and that's worth something to you. And I suppose I can relate to that because I'm director of a non-profit making organisation, the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. I'm embarrassed about turning in a small loss and worry about what my trustees will say if we turn in a small surplus, we don't make profits. If we turn in a small surplus, I'm perfectly happy, and so are they. So I can understand this asymmetry, but I come back to the point that it must indicate a departure from the beneficiary's interest. And I think another issue that I would like to hear more about is the question of the sponsor's perspective. Now, the model suggested, and rightly, that if we have background risk, then in any framework where people are risk averse, they will raise saving. In my framework, in the example considered here, they'll raise funding. That's what you would normally expect to happen. But it raises the interesting question, and that is discussed to some extent in the paper. The sponsor actually has a choice. Should the sponsor agree to raise funding, or should the sponsor try and keep reserves outside the pension scheme? And one can think of all sorts of reasons why sponsors might want to keep the reserves outside the pension scheme. I think the most obvious one is in some sense a fallacy. Like the situation faced by students running a May ball, and I remember this example, who decided not to insure all the marquees against fire because they weren't all likely to burn down. So they paid a partial premium and were then somewhat surprised to discover that when one marquee did burn down, the insurance company only wanted to pay out a part of the loss. In fact, the insurance company needed quite a lot of persuading to pay out on the whole of the loss, and were persuaded to do so in the end. By the college, not by the students. The sponsor is likely to think, well, there are a number of things that can go wrong. If I keep the reserves outside the system, then I can use those reserves to hedge against a number of risks. If they go into the system, they're lost into the pension scheme. Well, of course, the fallacy with that is that if the risks that the firm faces are independent of each other, it can't use a single pool of money to address all of them. But my guess is that one would hear that example and one would hear that argument, and a lot of sponsors would be likely to have that in mind when they say that they'd rather keep the reserves outside because that arrangement is more flexible. But equally, the trustees do have to think a bit further ahead than the two-period model that Mike described. I think there is a reasonable argument, and in some sense this is what we saw in the 1990s, that if funds do have surpluses, then trustees and sponsors between them do tend to reduce contributions and may also raise payouts to beneficiaries. We saw both of those going on. In the 1990s, this seems not to have happened, except possibly with the university superannuation scheme, to make the argument, yes, the fund is in surplus, but something could go wrong, and therefore we need to hang on to the surplus instead of dispersing it in some way. So I think another message that perhaps another point that isn't made in this paper, but I think an important point about actuaries, an important message for actuaries, is that given background risk, you don't just raise your funding, you don't just see it on a two-period basis. You have to accept a situation and defend a situation where funds are normally in surplus because they need to keep reserves to address background risk. In just the same way as banks need to keep reserves to deal with things going wrong and the normal losses on loans that faces the normal losses on loans that banks face should be dealt with by the normal risk premium that they charge. Reserves for banks and pension schemes are needed to deal with abnormal, well, unusual or background risks. Those background risks, by their nature, don't appear every year or every decade, and therefore the public, the sponsors, the trustees, the beneficiaries need educating about an appropriate response to them. So, that has been a mixture of questions I have raised and messages I have drawn from the paper, but I would again like to congratulate the authors on an excellent paper on an issue which I think is key for the actuarial profession. Thank you.
Well, the discussion is now open to the floor. I do have two names of people who want to speak. Just so I can get some idea, without committing yourselves, can you put your hand up if you may wish to speak? Okay. Those who do are thinking about it, please don't be, if you're a guest, don't be put off by the fact that our proceedings are recorded. You will be given an opportunity to see your comments before they are published in the BAJ. I don't think we need impose any formal time restrictions on speakers, although please avoid verbosity. You can either speak from the lectern or there are two roving microphones available. If you do speak, please ensure that your mobile phone is completely switched off, as a mute mobile phone can interfere with our recording equipment. So if I would like to call the two people who put their names down first, Andrew Smith, please, first.
Mr. President, no, Deputy President, Vice President, ladies and gentlemen, which are you, Peter? Senior Vice President, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Hope that bit won't be minuted. I welcome this paper because the implication of non-tradable risks and of incomplete markets are becoming increasingly important for both pensions and insurance work. And it's helpful to have an exposition of the concept of precautionary saving and how it relates to the third derivative of utility. That's fascinating. Section 4.2.3 acknowledges the existence of several parties to a pension plan, particularly the members and the sponsor. And Martin Wheel has already pointed out that the interests of trustees might differ from those of active members or from deferreds and pensioners. I would add the distinction between corporate managers compared to their shareholders, and also consider the incentives facing consultants and facing fund managers. As section 4.5.1 indicates, and Martin Wheel confirmed, the classical approach would be to consider each player in turn and ascribe a utility function to them. You then look for an equilibrium in which no player can increase their utility, given their rational views about other players' strategies. In contrast, today's paper takes a novel approach to multi-party analysis. Section 4.2.3 proposes a bargaining process whose result is apparently a single consensus utility parameter shared by all parties. However, I couldn't find the assumptions about bargaining power which have actually been used to derive the utility functions that the authors propose. As the results seem rather sensitive to the choice of utility functions, this empirical calibration, I think, is a significant omission, and I'd be interested to hear the author's ideas on how they'd, in practice, carry out that calibration. I found section 4.2.1 rather odd. The paper appears to argue that utility functions are only relevant when markets are incomplete. I wondered where the authors gained this impression. Regrettably, they haven't given a reference to source that view. In the same paragraph, I believe the authors may be mistaken in equating the corporate approach to the assumption of market completeness. In my view, the corporate approach is about recognising multiple stakeholders with multiple investment opportunities. It doesn't require all risks to be traded. In fact, in today's paper, I didn't see where the authors recognise the possibility that fund stakeholders may have risks and investments elsewhere. I'm not only talking about investment risks, but consider, for example, longevity, where, in the context of today's paper, if mortality expectations improve, it comes out as a bad thing because you get a bigger deficit. But for most of us in this room, if we're told we're going to live longer, we probably regard that as a good thing. So the sign that we attach to that risk could be different if you take into account the stake that I have in all sorts of other aspects of my life. I think the choice of time horizon also deserves some more discussion. When I was training to be an actuary, I heard about the importance of the long term for pension funding and investment. And in his opening remarks, Michael Orsag talked about how the classical assumptions of some parts of economics will break down when you're considering long-term financial institutions. And the description of the model in section 4.5.3 seems to be a multi-period model. But then section 5.4 suggests that the results are based on one or two period horizons. But although I'm not completely convinced by all the actuarial long-term arguments, it does seem odd that a paper on longevity risk and equity investments should focus on a one or two year horizon. And I'd be interested to hear the author's comments on that. Slightly frustrating that the paper's conclusions aren't conclusive. As Michael Orsag's already mentioned, their figures reveal that an allowance for background risk either reduces or increases the optimal level of funding. It also either increases or reduces the proportion of the fund to be invested in equities. But even in my most curmudgeonly moments, I struggle to disagree with all the conclusions in this paper simultaneously. And I wonder whether those results tell us as much about the author's interesting choice of utility function and time horizon as they do about background risk. Nevertheless, I thank the authors for the paper, and I hope we'll get an interesting discussion. Thanks.
I'd now like to call Juan Coco.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. As you probably noticed from my discussion, my background is not being an actuary. I'm a finance professor at London Business School. So my discussion will be a bit more more towards conceptual I'm going to try to highlight the important things in this approach, instead of trying to attack each and single assumption of the model. Okay. Every model has several assumptions. Every assumption has its own problems. One particular assumption that was previously discussed here is the assumption of the kink in the preferences. I don't know if it would be possible to put the kink up. be possible to show the slide, please? Okay. And the reason why I want to spend a little bit of time on this is because I think this is extremely, extremely important to understand what's going on here in terms of these preferences. Okay. So what is the idea behind having a king in preferences? The idea behind having a king in preferences, I've asked to put the slide up so that we all understand what's going on, is that increases in value above the king are less important than decreases below the king. If you remember the slopes of the line, the king was like this, which means that going 1% up matters less than going 1% down. So we are penalized by losses, we don't gain as much on the upside. That's the idea of the king. Okay? Now, why is this important? Why do we think that sometimes there should be a king in preferences? Okay, think about the firm's perspective. There is a possibility that the firm will go bankrupt with all the costs associated with that. Do we want to take the chance that the firm will go bankrupt? No. Okay? So if we are close to bankruptcy point, we lose more on the downside than we gain on the upside. So there's going to be a king there. Okay? Think about my saving for my retirement. It's a long time away, but I've started thinking about it. Okay? Throughout my lifetime, I will get used to a certain lifestyle. Okay? I will get used to my car, I'll get used to my house, I'll get used to consuming certain goods, I'll get used to going on holiday to a warm country. Is that going to introduce a kink in my utility function? It is going, yes, it will, okay? I have a given subsistence level, and I want to be able to maintain that style of living that I'm used to, okay? So this is basically to say that kinks in utility functions are important from the point of view of firms, and they are important from the point of view of individuals, okay? If you think that people get used to their lifestyle, which I think people do, then kinks in utility functions are very important, okay? So this is the first on the preferences, why I think that it's important to analyze kings. Okay? What is the problem when we start analyzing kings? The first problem is, where is the king? Okay? Now, Mike put there that the king is at 100%, meaning that we want 100% funding of my pension plan, meaning that no, only above 100% I gain less than what I lose if I go down below 100%. Okay? Who decides on this 100%? It's not clear, okay? That's a difficulty with this kink utility function, okay? Why is it 100%? Why is the slope on the upside 1 and on the downside 0.5? Okay, who decides these things? Is it the company? Is it the trustees? Is it who decides on these things, okay? It's very hard to decide on these things. Okay? If you're concerned about bankruptcy of the company, clearly the king should not be on 100%, meaning the scheme should be fully funded. Okay? Okay. Once we accept that we have a king utility function, I hope that I've made the case for the fact that we should at least think about the possibility that there are kings in utility functions, then it's very easy to see why the results can go in different directions. Okay? Think about the fact that we are just above the king. Okay? There is no background risk and we are just above the king. And we are investing in equities. Okay? But because there is no background risk, there is no possibility that we'll go below the king. Okay? Now, add background risk. When you add this background risk, it becomes possible that we go below the king. So will I want to change my asset allocation? Yes, I will want to change my asset allocation. Okay? So this is basically to say that once you buy the idea that there can be a king in preferences, that both from the firm point of view and from an household point of view, results can go in all sorts of directions, okay? Does this mean that we should ignore them? No, it means that we should try to understand in which direction they can go and for which reason they can go, okay? There is stuff that you can do about the king, okay? You can buy options to avoid going below the king, okay? If you think that there is a king and you're really worried about it, you can buy options, put options in order to avoid going below the king, okay? If you're a household worried about the king in preferences, you can invest in safe assets to avoid the background risk together with the risk of equities, okay? So this is my first point, which is a specific point, and I want to spend a little bit of time on discussing. Okay. The other thing, which is a more general comment that I would like the authors to do, is one thing that I'm kind of missing from the paper was real estate and real estate returns. I have done some work on it, and one important thing about real estate in a model with background risk is the following. If you think that you are a company with a defined benefit, final salary plan, and so one important risk of this sort of schemes is wage growth. Okay, depending on what wage is going to grow, then you may be facing background risk due to this source. Okay, if you are in such a setting and there is this source of background risk, having real estate as an asset can be very valuable because the returns on real estate are very positively correlated with the returns on earnings growth. Okay, with earnings growth, sorry, not the returns on earnings, but with earnings growth. So one dimension that I would focus the authors to expand their work is in looking at background wage growth as the background risk and incorporating in their model another asset, which is real estate returns. They could compute the correlation between the two. It's likely to be very large and positive and could give some interesting implications for portfolio location of pension funds in terms of real estate property in general. Okay, I had these two main comments, but other than that, I think it's a very interesting paper. I encourage you to read. There is some restrictive assumptions in the paper, but it's true about all models. The more important thing is that I think that is important and worthwhile to think about key kinks in utility functions and the effects that has, and it's important to think about background risks. Thank you very much.
Right, now then, do we have another speaker, a gentleman there, and anybody to follow him? To follow then. Could you please now, as I haven't announced your name...
Hi, my name is David McCarthy from Tanaka Business School at Imperial College. I'd just like to thank the authors for the paper. I think background risk is a really important issue. I think it's an extremely complex issue and one that needs to be looked at in the context of pension funds. I'm not going to quibble about the assumptions of the model. I think I agree with all the previous speakers and the authors in that one shouldn't take the outcomes of the models they've shown literally. I think they're just purely illustrative. And I think the conclusion of the paper that background risk can either increase or decrease equity investment or increase or decrease funding in principle is probably correct. Of course, in practice, which way it would go, I think, is quite different. I said I wouldn't quibble with the assumptions, but I'm going to keep my comments fairly brief. And so I will raise one particular issue, and I think that is, if one looks at the sources of background risk that members face, I think probably the most important source of background risk faced by members is the risk of default of the company, right? And I think in that case there is an unusual interaction between the level of funding of the pension plan and the background risk. And this is lessened by the presence of the PPF, but not entirely, because there will be members of the fund who have pensions of more than £25,000. And so that would be my one quibble with the assumption. But I think that, as many of the speakers have said, one shouldn't really take the conclusions of the model too literally. But I do welcome the paper. I think it's a very interesting study of a great area, and I look forward to hearing more from these authors. Thank you very much.
Gentleman down here. Do you want to speak from the lectern or?
So my name is William Peridin. I'm a professor at Tanaka Business School, and I have two points I wanted to raise. The first is I think it's very important to consider carefully what's the relative magnitudes of these different risks. So if we have hedgeable risks on the one hand and what we're calling background risks as non-hedgeable risks on the other hand, then I think it's really important to reflect on their relative magnitude. And it's difficult to do that in a convincing statistical way, but at the very least we can look back on what's happened in the last few years. I mean, after all, we are very interested. I mean, I guess everyone in the room is very interested in these issues of asset allocation and funding levels for pension schemes. And I mean, that's very much to some people would have been interested in it anyway, but others are particularly interested in it because of the problems that pension funds have experienced in with deficits in the last few years. And in a previous incarnation, I was a special advisor to the Bank of England, and we did quite a careful breakdown of the relative contribution to deficits in major schemes coming from changes in tax policy, changes in demographics, perhaps unexpected shocks to demographics, and then changes to market prices. And our estimates, I think in common with some other estimates that have been produced by the industry, suggested that the big bulk of the problem in the last few years was this double whammy, a very unusual fall in the equity market coinciding with a fall in interest rates. Normally you'd expect a fall in the equity market, well, you'd expect if interest rates fall, a standard kind of financial econometrician would say, well, we will see the equity market rising. So that double whammy of hedgeable market risk shocks has led to the problems that we currently face. So on the one hand, I'm intellectually interested by the point that's being made in the paper that background risk should be taken into account in designing optimal funding and optimal asset allocation decisions. But on the other hand, I'm a bit concerned if the paper obscures in any way the fact that a lot of the current problems stemmed from perhaps a misunderstanding of the hedgeable risks that were faced by some schemes. So that's my first point. My second point, which is much shorter, is just to say that this distinction between background and hedgeable risks is helpful in the sense that it pushes us all to reflect on why background risks are background. Why are they non-hedgeable? And I think, in a sense, these risks are not non-hedgeable because insurance companies in the past have been willing to provide bulk annuity buyouts of different sorts, not necessarily on deferred liabilities, but on at least some sorts of liabilities. So why has that access to hedging not grown? Why is it that the pension, that the insurance companies and then reinsurance markets have not been able to provide a conduit for people to, for insurance schemes to hedge these risks? And I think we in that area we have to worry about the regulatory environment that the pension funds face to some, that the insurance funds face to some extent. And I think we also need to worry about the way in which actuaries value some of these pension liabilities, because when I've talked to firms that have been considering whether they try and go for an insurance route to reduce some of their liabilities, I mean, they are impressed with the fact that commonly, the estimates of the values of the liabilities held within the scheme are much less than the price that the insurance companies will put on them. So it may be that the insurance companies, because of capital constraints and over-regulation or tight regulation, have to price these things very high, or it may be that the schemes themselves should really accept the fact or be advised that these liabilities are very expensive, and hence an insurance, you know, the cost of getting insurance, should be accepted in a way. So I think that the the way in which we think about the valuation of liabilities is all part of the same issue of why these liabilities are not marketed more.
Oh.